Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Friends and family, where people are getting together, you've come over and we're just, it's a Tuesday night or Friday night, we're popping a bottle of wine that's your wine with your label that I help you make. And that you're just enjoying the best parts of your life with your friends and family, or loved one, whatever. And I take a lot of satisfaction knowing that I'm kind of part of all these different people's experiences in their life. Mostly, again, with wine, a lot of times with my family and friends, that's part of the what we remember the most, and helps to make an average night or whatever, a normal night, into an amazing night. So it's kind of fun to feel like I've had this little part of all these different lives across the world. I mean, not only just here. I mean, it's just funny. I mean, even in China and Hong Kong or the Philippines or Japan, we've had clients in all over the place that are enjoying right now, currently, hopefully enjoying wine as we speak, that we help to facilitate. And I said, typically, hopefully it's for sorrowful night where you're drinking to forget. Hopefully you're drinking to remember, to those moments with your best peeps. And so
it's kind of like the opposite of I can't get no satisfaction. So, and there's a label there somewhere that I will take totally credit for.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
No, I love
it's,
it.
It's super romantic. It's definitely a lot of fun to have those connections with people. And we have I think a super special role in helping to facilitate these moments. And these are the moments that you remember down the road. And so much of these revolve around, especially again with my family and friends, with the wines that we love. And it helps to make those moments even better. And so even with the smallest amount of credit towards that, it's pretty fun to think about.
You know, philosophically speaking, early in the conversation we talked about the romance of it and the drinking part and the amusement and the social aspects. You can get there. It just takes a heck of a lot of hard work. Mm. But there's that reward in the end. So I think it's important to point it out because people romanticize all of it, or maybe, you know, on the front end they don't realize
for
what
sure.
they're getting into.
Yeah.
But it does exist.
I totally did. I was thinking more like this, what we're doing right now, after tasting wine all day. I was thinking more like this. I wasn't thinking, you know, driving the forklift and working long hours, you know, showing up at the winery at 5 in the morning when it's misting and raining and you're on the forklift unloading trucks or having to pressure wash the drains or
climbing barrel
and just of doing
cleaning
the drain is one of the worst part. Or just even a normal day bottling, quite frankly, is not my favorite.
Let's just say that on your worst day of the worst grind, would you still rather be here?
Oh yeah, for sure. It's amazing. It does take. You know, I encourage anyone and everyone to explore as many days as possible, as many moments as possible, doing the things that you want to do, and as few as possible that doing what you have to do. And so that if you love to make wine, or you love to cook, or you love to dance, then you should be doing those as much as you can. Because before you know it, those moments aren't around anymore, and so you'll be wishing that you had spent more time making wine or more time drinking wine, maybe, too.
Well, and I mean, honestly, what makes it worth it is so I'm drinking this glass of wine, and it's getting better and better as I drink it, but it's, you know, just opening up more and more and more, and it's getting more and more satisfying.
Is
and
it so kept
yeah so this is actually this is a for our, from our foundry lineup this is a 2016 Cab Franc from Stagecoach. I think it's 2016 Cab Franc from Stagecoach Vineyard. It actually is 100% Cab Franc, blend of 5 different barrels. Patrick tried, and I usually sit in on most of his kind of, once he's trying to hone in on the blend, he sort of bounces things off of a couple of us, and he tried like 30 some odd different blends on it and just came back to the, you know what, these 5 barrels are, and we always tell people, don't do anything 100%, like just that single wine. It's going to benefit from a blend, but this is still fantastic, and it's opening up and opening it up. And that makes, it literally washes away, you know, like, I don't know, it's been a hot week, a hot day. Yesterday was brutally hot. Lots of frustrations because of whatever reason, just it happens this time of year. And I'm not thinking about anything other than how kick-ass this wine smells and tastes, you know.
Great therapy, excuse me. Right?
Yes.
So I'm curious about the actual process. Let's just say I'm a client and mm-hmm. I've drank a lot of good wine and I just have this burning desire to make my own. So I heard a lot of value proposition.
Yeah.
But I want to know the actual process. Do clients get to choose fruit sources? Do you?
Yeah. So I mean, it really helps to have, you know, a goal, of course. So. Yep. Depending on the client, it might be a brand or a certain wine that mm-hmm. you like already, like you love.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Camus Select Cabernet Sauvignon.
So
this,
you know the style.
So you would like to, I want to make a wine like Camus Select
mm-hmm.
Cab.
Mm-hmm.
And, or I want to make Opus 1, or I want to, whatever it is. It mm-hmm. could be, or I want to make Costa Brown Pinot Noir, or whatever it is. And so you have to have some sort of benchmark, I guess, or something, a goal
that's
that you're shooting for.
It.
It really helps to have a wine, a brand, or a style that we can reference, and so because we know based on Camus what they've done, you know, and so you can kind of reverse engineer the wine that you're doing based on the
goal of it. So you can taste it and really break it down in your mind.
For sure. Well, there's a lot of, first of all, there's a lot of information out there in general, and I've of course made a lot of wines and or had a lot of wines, so there's, you can gain a lot of insight into what has been done either by on the chemistry or by just by tasting the wine. And or by finding out what they, you know, by looking literally on their website or what they've done itself.
Read between the lines.
But in the case of something like Camus or Opus 1 or one of the, you know, Joseph Phelps, those are all popular for Bordeaux blend benchmarks. Those are all popular benchmarks because they're very well known. And there's a lot of information about that. So we can know, okay, so where are the fruit sources from that? Oh, the Rutherford base. Okay, so let's start with the G3, the George III vineyard. And so because you're looking for a Rutherford style wine, or you want to start from Melrose. So we have a couple, in this case, Belt and Beckstoffer properties that we could use to be the basis of the wine. So the basis would be the George III cab or the Melrose cab or Stagecoach Vineyard cab or whatever the particular vineyard, if it was a Cabernet, it would be whatever was the closest would be to that style that we're shooting for. A mountain fruit would brings different qualities than valley floor fruit.
Yeah.
So if you were into kale, was mentioned on his when you spoke with Kale
mm-hmm.
last week or a couple weeks, he was mentioning about how mountain fruit was very attractive to him, and
yes.
so that he gravitated towards that. When we were at Davis together, he would taste mountain fruit and be like, it's hard not to like mountain, particularly mountain Cabernet particularly.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's hard not to like it. And so it's easy to see why Kale or anybody else would gravitate towards that. And so if that was the goal behind it, you would want to work with a mountain fruit. And so as you would want to work with Stagecoach Vineyard or comparable vineyard as opposed to the valley floor fruit like George III, which is much more lush and less structure driven and more about. And so if you're looking for volume of palate, particularly front mid palate, you might want George III. But if you want more front to back structure and tannin based wine, you probably prefer the block that we get from Stagecoach.
So you kind of decide.
So we basically start them with a basis, you know. So we get kind of the close. We kind of like do. And when you're in microbiology, you do kind of like the grow. You know, when you're tuning the contrast for a microscope, you do the gross tuning on the big dots, and then you do the fine tuning as you get closer, right? So we would get as close to where to being in view and focus, thank you. The focus was the word I was looking for. And then we would get closer by fine tuning. In the case of Cabernet Sauvignon, you would fine tune it with Cabernet Franc or Merlot or Malbec or Petit Verdot.
Mm-hmm.
So you almost likely, you probably should have some amount of PV in the wine. Question's how much, and if so, how much PV you add, how much Cab Franc or Merlot or Malbec would you add to complete the palate? And that's client driven based on the profile that they're looking to do. And so
when they want it to show well,
right? So somebody, we oftentimes, I tell people, we probably like the same wine, but we might like it at different times. So you might like it, if you liked all fruit and youthfulness, you might like it right after bottling. If somebody wants more maturity or more subtlety or, you know, polished tannins. They might like it 2 or 4 or 5 years down the road, bottle aged. So it depends on the profile you're looking to get. The same wine changes dramatically. Cab doesn't change quite as dramatically as a young white wine does, or orange wine, in the first year particularly. But over the life of itself, it does change dramatically. And depending on when you like it, you might like it at 1 day in, or 101 days in, or 1,001 days in. So it really depends on where you fit on the spectrum. And so there's not a right or wrong. So each client is different. So I try to, each client has a different timeline they're looking for it to be impressive at. So I have to adjust the blends. That comes to some of the gross tuning, but more of the fine tuning with based on how we blend the wine out. So with Cabernet, if you put more Petit Verdot in the wine, it amplifies the tannins and makes the wine bigger and rougher. The question is, do you want that? And or do you want it, if we're shooting for a right way? Many of my clients have wines, you know, hundreds of bottles or thousands of bottles of wine already ahead of this wine that we're making for them. So we're shooting for 2, 4, 8 years down the road, not 2, 4, 8 months down the road. So it's a different wine you'd want to blend for a 2, 4, 8 year down the road than the 2, 4 months, you know, down the road. So it just depends on when we're trying to be impressive and who's the judge. So come judgment day, we want the wine to be where we want it to be. So you're the judge. You get to decide when's judgment day and what's your judgment. And so that's the best part about being a wine taster, is that you're the judge. The hardest part is that will it be the good judgment or not? And so, you know, that depends on what you're drinking and when you want it to be good. The hard part of making wines that are range over a range of time for a range of people is, again, is that not everyone's on the same schedule. So some people want to eat early, some people want to eat at 7 o'clock, some people want to come in later. So you can't make the same dish to be ready to go for all those same groups, because they're coming in at different times or want to eat them at different times. So that's a hard part of having a number of clients and wines. Wines in general the same wines has a range of impressiveness to a range of people over a range of time. That's hard to do to make everyone happy at the same time or over the same period of time. So
Describing is really a fascinating concept, to be able to design the wine, utilizing so many different variables. You know, unlike buying, you know, from, you know, vineyard source or whatever, yeah. When you're doing it as a consumer, you actually get a much broader.
Yeah, I worked in the restaurant business for a long time, but I was front of house, not back of house. Now back of house and me in the wine business. But I told people that, I have a lot of chef friends, and I told them, yeah, but that's pretty easy to be a chef, because all you got to do is make that salmon dish taste good, like in 20 minutes from now, or, you know, or 30 minutes from now. I said, I have to make my salmon dish taste good for the next 2 years, or taste good in 2 years. And so they'd be like, you know, I know the salmon's going to be good now, but let's just try this 2 years from now and see what you think with it. With wine, particularly, as I said, when you're aiming down the road with a Cabernet or something else, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. And so it's hard to run a marathon for sure, and or to wait till the end of the marathon to make your judgment. Because generally, as you're running, you think that, yeah, that's a strange analogy perhaps, but the basically boils down to it's hard to make it to be impressive.
It's all data points, though, you know, yeah. And it's what you pick up along the way. And so for the wine foundry model, we source from, I don't know, 24, 26, 30 different vineyards, depending on the year. And so if he's talking to somebody about a Cabernet Sauvignon, then they have 8 different vineyards and they start the conversation there. And then, you know, the commercial example of if somebody says, okay, Joseph Phelps, but then it's really about tasting that with them and calibrating their.
Yeah, it could be a good point. It could be a profile. Kind of back to your, I didn't answer your question. Steve brought us back to the topic. The was how do we indoor? How do we get to where clients can get to where they get what they were hoping for? Again, it's having some sort of goal, and it could be a profile thing. Joseph Phelps is a very polished tannins, typically, especially bottle aged wine. People are usually, you know, I like the analogy of upstream and downstream. People are used to being downstream only, not to seeing what it's like being upstream. So they don't know what it's like to be upstream. So they only know what it's like to have had bottle aged the wine to be bottled and to be aged already for months or years in bottle before they've tasted the wine. And so the wine varies quite a bit over that time frame. So being farther upstream, you have to know if we're on the right spot to upstream to be where we need to be downstream. And that only comes with experience of going up and down the stream a number of times to decide, are we on track to get downstream and be where the client wants the wine to be 36 months from now or 36 days from now?
It seems to me like a very complex communication task as well, because you have to be able to relate all of
it's
that.
It's just, yeah, it
well,
comes it, with...
And that's why it's, I think that's why it's really helpful to, you know, taste the same wine, because somebody, we've had a lot of folks say, and this isn't a knock on them at all, but they'll say, oh, I love, there's nothing I love more than just, you know, Bordeaux, old world, restraint, you know, like realm, or, you know what I mean? And so,
they,
we're like,
no,
okay.
So unfortunately, so this is a good point. So yeah, they don't, not everyone is consistent with their I call it wineese.
Yeah.
And so it's the language of wine, and it's wineese. It's not everyone is consistent with what they say. Many, many clients, many times, he knows this because I've told him this too, where they say, I want this one thing. I want something really restrained. And then they go and they taste this 15, 16% alcohol cab or something full, you know, with 100% new oak and go, yeah, this is a good example. And which, by the way, is a totally fine thing to like, but that's not what restraint means when you're saying it. So the hard part is meaning what you say and saying what you mean. And or again, so the only
and
way to
speaking the right language.
Yeah, well, we calibrate,
together,
Steve. So yeah, so the only way I can know if you're actually meaning what you say and saying what you mean is to taste wine with you, and then for you to talk about it, and so that I can say, oh, I calibrate. I have to calibrate to everyone, and so that if you're the client, I have to say, okay, what do you mean when you say acidic, or what do you mean when you mean restraint, or what do you mean when you mean full-bodied, and so forth. So we have to taste wine together, and you characterize it, and then I adjust. And so that's a matter of calibration. And so because not everyone feels the same way about, you know, these different parameters in wine, acidity and astringency, bitterness, fruitiness, oakiness, alcohol extraction, and so forth and so on. There are many, many things on the radar of a wine, and depending on your preference for each one of those parameters, you're going to have a certain response. And if you can't articulate your response, it's hard to know what you think. So that's why we taste wine together. You can say, I think this, and then I can say, I can adjust. So that's the hard part is learning how to adjust. So it's learning what people mean when they say certain things.
And you have anecdotes besides the one that you shared? Because I found it utterly fascinating. Anything from your history?
Well, no, he says that because we had a client that would say, that I'm gonna say she. It may have been a she.
Either one.
It could have been. It was definitely not a she. But she says, I want restraint. I want more. I want something else. And then they taste the wine out of the lineup. The one that was the biggest wine, the most kind of new world wine. It was the almost opposite of what they said.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what did you mean to say? What you said, or did you, or do you not know what restraint is, or do you not know what whatever is.
Or is this what restraint is to you?
Or is this restraint to you? Correct. Is this really what's right. What it is? That's the more correct way. Is that everything is relative.
It's definitely the nicer way to say it.
Perhaps.
Better than saying, you're wrong.
Do you
I'm
not
right.
know what you're saying? You know. but it's interesting to me how people, you know, it's just a matter of tasting wine together, and then we're using, just like if we were talking about something else, about art or music, until we start talking about and using the same words in the same way, we might refer to the things differently. And so as soon as we calibrate and now we're using the language in the same way, then we can talk openly, and then we know that when you say this, you mean that.
So what happens, this is such a fascinating subject, seriously, the language of wine and the perceptive value and how subjective it is. And even within the industry, I think we're talking past each other often, so let alone the poor consumer.
Totally.
You know, who's so intimidated by it. But back to the production part of it for a moment. So do they get to choose, with your advice, of course,
so yes,
the barrels?
They do. So so there's a lot of things. There's a lot of touch points, if you will, or a lot of choices that can be involved in it. You know, if you or they have... the knowledge to be able to decide, you know, I want to go with this, I want a Vicard barrel, I want a Tarancio barrel, I want a you know, this particular cooper, mm-hmm. then I will adhere to your preferences. Mm-hmm. If you say to me, which barrel should I go with? And I say, okay, well, what wines do you like? Oh. I like Opus 1. Okay. Or I like, you know, whatever your kind of benchmarks are. I learned quite a bit by you having a goal, you know, so mm-hmm. I know quite a bit about the different wines that are being produced and say, okay, based on the profile, particularly if you like Realm or you like Opus 1 or Alpha Omega, then you're going to like a certain profile of wine and a certain profile of barrel. So what I do is I have a range of, just like any good chef would have, a range of tools, a range of spices, a range of logistics and things available to me to change the profile around to match the preference that you're trying to do. So if you like Alpha Omega, for example, you probably like a lot of oak. And so I definitely want to use, and there's certain coopers like that the oak impact on a wine, they're kind of a more aggressive, if you will, on the wine. And so you probably prefer those types, those coopers. One of those coopers would work better for your wine, probably, at least for a period of time. And so then it'd just be an adjustment. Everything is customized, and that's part of the difficulty of doing our business model, is that it's custom.
That's what I'm trying to wrap my brain around. Yeah. Like if somebody's making two barrels of wine, you have to purchase two barrels from that particular cooperage, and then purchase completely different set of, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what I do is I equip myself with a full gamut of tools to work with, and so that I have intentionally buy more restrained barrels and more in medium barrels and more impacting barrels. So just that one variable, as you mentioned, there's a lot of variables that we can isolate. The oak is one of them for sure. And so because we're working on high end, we're not working on, you know, lower ended fruit or lower ended wines in general. I buy all French oak and buy very expensive barrels, but they have a huge range of impact. And so some are more restrained and show more elegance, and some show more weight and smoke and char and ash and heavier. There's a huge range. I get a huge range of clients. It's not one. As I said, I have 120 or two, one, you know, depending on the vintage, 100 to 200 different clients at a time, and they all have a range of preferences. So each one of them I would customize for them. And so it's not a one size fits all model. It's a 120 sizes or 200 sizes fits all type of model. And so there, it really is. So you would might very much, so I know that you're going to like French oak on your Cabernet, but which French oak and for how long? And how long, what do I pair that with? Do I put in X amount? It would be based on what you want, of course. And the only way I know that is by tasting with you and then trying different things with you and letting you decide. So now we're 20 months in or 18 months in to the Cabernet process for your barrel of Cabernet. It's the 2017 vintage of Cabernet that you have. You have a barrel of Stagecoach Cab or you have a barrel of George III Cab. And you sit down and we try the wine as is. And we talk about what we like about the wine and what we would prefer to be different. And then we try the blending components. I have Cabernet Franc from Stagecoach and I have Merlot from Broken Rock and Malbec from Herringer and Petit Verdot from Stagecoach, and I have all these different components to work with. And I have other varietals too. If you don't want to be traditional, if you want to make an outside-the-box blend and you want to put Grenache into your cab or Syrah into your cab, then we'll do that. And I have all those as well. But if you want to be traditionalist and you want to just put in the Bordeaux varieties, no problem. We can work with those as well. The question is how much of those things and what ratio of each. And the only way to know that is to try it at different ratios. You turn this up, you turn that down, and you have all these different things in front of you, and we adjust based on how we respond. So
the variables have to be...
The variables are significant. Yeah, it isn't. That's not...
You did say you had a PhD in consumption.
It's not an easy process, right?
And but even on the supplier side, I mean, you work with coopers, I would imagine, multitudes
of
hybrid barrels as well?
Indeed. We're working with... In general, as I said, because we're making wines on the higher end of the spectrum, I'd say in general, I want to give the higher end of quality, and that really is, with all due respect to the sources of wood from other countries, French oak is, I think, by most people's agreement, the highest quality that you can buy.
Is it because of the tightness of the grain?
It's primarily in the weather patterns in France and in how the oak grows and that. So in our lifetime, the last 150 to 200 years, this particular species of oak, I think, does best in the center of France particularly. And in the future, it's going to be, it might adjust, and we might have to adjust as winemakers in the future to growing to where. But currently, the best conditions for this particular species of oak, which I think is the best species of oak to work with for higher end wines, particularly, it's just, it's a profile thing. It's not my opinion. It's not the only opinion for sure. And but I do think that we definitely spend the most amount of money to buy these barrels. You know, anywhere from $750 on the low side, 100 euros, to, you know, almost 1,000 euros per barrel. So, you know, you're talking about $1,200, $1,000 to $1,200 a barrel that can be used for 4 or 5 years primarily before you lose all oakiness in the wine. It's just that the barrel is not just neutral. And so if you want it, if you need a neutral vessel, then that works fine. But if you're trying to get oakiness, which for Cab and for Bordeaux blends or for heavier red blends in general, you're trying to absorb, you generally want amount of oak on the profile. So you have to use a certain amount of newer oak to get there. And so the newer the oak, the more the impact, and the style driven. And so the client decides based on the client's profile decides the direction of the wine. There's not one recipe for it. There's 1,000 recipes for it.
Do you trial independently just for your own?
Oh, for sure. The only way you gain experience and knowledge, whether you're cooking or you're making wine or you're brewing or doing anything else, is by trial and error. You do this thing. What was the result? Should I replicate it?
Yeah.
And so that's how you learn how to make great wine. Is to start with great grapes, treat it really greatly, and then analyze the and reflect on the results, and then replicate. And so the hard part is starting with the same type of logistics and the same type of quality material. If you work with the same vineyards, you have a chance, but then the conditions change or other things change for you. It's always very difficult to hit that same note every single time.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.